call the case.
Good morning. My name is James Tabit. I am representing Mr. Minaapo. Also present is Ms. Karen Nakasone. She will be representing Mr. Lopez. I would like to reserve 10 minutes, or we would like to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal. This is kind of unusual because I've never done co-counsel, but the 35 minutes that's remaining, I anticipate using 15 minutes, and Ms. Nakasone will take the remaining 20. I will focus only on the mistake of fact issues. My case only involves that. Ms. Nakasone will address not only the mistake of fact, but the prosecutorial misconduct issue. Before I begin, after State v. Polisbo was issued in 2000, the circuit court judges have been split on the issue of whether the mistake of fact defense is available to defendants who mistakenly believe that the person they got the car from was the actual owner. Some judges give the instruction, the mistake of fact instructions. Some judges refuse. Some judges even go to the point where they don't even allow us to introduce evidence similar to mistake of fact. So, and also adding to some of the confusion as well is the appellate courts have actually issued conflicting unpublished opinions in this area. First of all, we have Minaapo and Lopez saying that it's the ICA is saying that it's defendants are not entitled to instruction. But just a couple years ago, there was a summary disposition order by this court indicating that it's error to preclude a defendant from raising that defense. So we appreciate this court accepting this writ, and we hope that a published opinion will actually resolve this issue once and for all in the circuit courts. Now, in my case, State v. Minaapo, the ICA held that the circuit court was not required to instruct the jury on the mistake of fact defense because there was no evidence that Mr. Minaapo mistakenly believed that the actual owner, Ms. Cordova, gave him permission to drive the car. The ICA based its decision, its erroneous decision, upon the holding in State v. Polisbo. According to the ICA, the mistake of fact defense can only apply in the narrow situation where the defendant was essentially dealing with the registered owner, and while dealing with the registered owner, somehow mistakenly misinterpreted the owner's words or actions as amounting to consent, which actually no consent was given. And clearly, Polisbo is not that narrow. It does not limit the mistake of fact defense to only that situation. I believe Polisbo was narrowly held that the evidence presented in that case only did not support a mistake of fact instruction. Because in Polisbo, the person who gave him permission to use the car was not the owner. It was clear. It was actually the co-defendant. The co-defendant says, "It's my cousin's car. Go ahead, just drive my car, or please drive my car because I don't know the area." So clearly, the defendant in Polisbo knew that the person who gave him permission was not the owner. There was no evidence that the defendant even tried to obtain consent from the owner or from the person who was purported to be the owner, even. So, based on those facts, there was no evidence. The defendant in Polisbo didn't present any evidence to support a mistake of fact instruction. Now, in my case, and as well as Mr. Lopez's case, the defendants did present evidence showing that they were under the mistaken belief that the owners had authorized them to operate the vehicles. Actually, first of all, Mr. Minaapo testified that he believed that the person who gave him the car, or who gave him consent to use the car, was the owner, the actual owner of the vehicle, the registered owner. He received a key from that person. That key fit the locks, the door locks, started the ignition. Mr. Minaapo
pretty weird key.
Well, see, that's, unfortunately, I wasn't at trial there, but this key, wasn't introduced in evidence, apparently, but I'm assuming it was a Nissan key. I don't think it was, I mean, I know the prosecution tried to make it sound like it's a magic or a master key, but there really is no concrete evidence that, at least there's evidence on our part that at least Mr. Mayanapo thought this is the key that opened this car. And he had no reason to believe that it was a
and it did indeed
master
open the car.
And it did open the doors. And actually, the condition of the car didn't even appear as a stolen, because it needed a key, apparently, because, you know, most stolen cars looked like they're punched locks, punched ignition, broken windows. So, he didn't have to have a reasonable belief, but he believed that this car belonged to this person, Doug. And Doug had lent the music car because he was going to go to boot camp. Evidence supporting the instruction as well, or his belief, is that there was valuable stuff in the car. I mean, that was supported by the complainant and the complainant's boyfriend. We're not talking, you know, we're talking a purse, cash, we're talking identification, we're talking credit cards, and some equipment. Mr. Mayanapo decides this is valuable stuff. He decides just puts it in the trunk of the car and let Doug deal with it when he comes back. So,
Chamba, what do you have to say about just Judge Nakamura's dissent? He differs from you in his analysis.
Yeah, Judge Nakamura's dissent, we appreciate the dissent. However, we disagree with the initial premise where he believes as well, or his opinion is that Polisbo applies only to that narrow situation. Just like the dissent does that. Because it applies to the narrow situation where the you have to deal with the registered owner and you just somehow misunderstood the registered owner giving consent or not. That's where he comes from. And because he believes that that's what Polisbo stands for, he thinks we should just overturn Polisbo.
Doesn't he think that Polisbo was wrongly decided?
He did. Yeah. Or do we think?
Doesn't Nakamura think
so? Yeah, Nakamura thinks so, yes. It's the same, yes. Because he reads Polisbo the same way that the ICA majority reads Polisbo. That it only applies in that narrow situation. He takes it one step further. He says that's not right, based on the legislative history, which we agree on. That part we agree on, the legislative history, that the mistake of this, because there's not, that the mistake of fact does apply to defendants in our situation.
So you part with just Judge Nakamura in that you think that you're not going to say that Polisbo was wrongly decided.
No.
You're just saying that it's applicable to the present
right,
case,
correct.
Cases.
Now, if this court is going to say our interpretation of Polisbo is wrong and the ICA's interpretation is correct, our fallback argument, as in our writ, my writ indicates, is that, okay, let's go with that, you know, let's follow Judge Nakamura's reasoning. And I don't think we need to say Polisbo is wrong, because it's clear that Polisbo, and I know the justice that wrote Polisbo is up here, and he probably could explain to us in more detail than I can, but it's fact-specific. It's the defendant in that case got the car from someone that wasn't the owner. He knew that. So the mistake of fact defense couldn't apply.
The ICA in Polisbo, signposting the way it was going to go about analyzing the points of error on appeal, stated that before addressing defendants' points on appeal, we believe it helpful to review the legislative history of HRS 708-836. Was that the right way to go about it?
Correct. That was the right way, because
In your view, is 708-836 plain and unambiguous?
Yes.
You believe that applying the plain and unambiguous terms literally would lead to an absurd or unjust result?
It would. if we're following the ICA, the Mayan-Apo ICA's.
If UCPV is plain and unambiguous,
no.
Then and doesn't then what absurd or unjust result would a literal application of the plain language of the statute lead to?
A literal, if the application was followed, if the law was applied correctly, there would be no unjust result. Because,
all right, and haven't we said over and over and over again that if a statute is plain and unambiguous, and if it doesn't, if its application does not produce an absurd or unjust result, it means what it says, and we do not look beyond it, and we don't look to legislative history.
Correct.
In fact, haven't we said, among other things, we do not resort to legislative history to cloud a statutory text that is clear. Do you disagree in any way with Judge Nakamura's statutory analysis of 836?
No, I don't. I do not. And I think it's actually consistent. I actually think it's consistent with Polisbo statutory analysis as well, because basically what in Polisbo, see, before the 1996 amendment, I think Mr. Polisbo would have gotten the instruction, because at that point owner meant anyone having the car. It could actually have been a thief, basically. If he had permission from that person, from any person, he's entitled to the instruction. But the 1996 amendment narrowed the definition of owner to registered owner. That took Mr. Polisbo outside of, it took him outside. That's why I think Polisbo needed to go into the legislative history at that point. And Justice Judge Nakamura further, I think, indicates that as well. And he takes it one step further, because he has the benefit of the 1990 amendments. And I think the legislator tried to include the word knowing as a state of mind. And there was a debate, apparently, whether knowing, reckless, which one should we have. And actually knowing, in my opinion, in my humble opinion, did very little to help the prosecution in securing more convictions, a reckless mistake of fact can still negate a knowing state of mind. Now, if they had gone down to reckless, then a reckless state of mind would not, and more convictions probably can be made by the prosecution at that point.
So it is an element of the substantive offense described in 708-836-1, is it not, that the defendant's control or operation of the propelled vehicle be without the registered owner's consent. That's an element.
Correct.
That's an attendant circumstance.
That's an attendant circumstance. So our position is that the state needs to prove that he knew the registered owner, and it's a defense, a mistake of fact defense, that whether reckless or not, or knowing, that the person that the defendant or Mr. Mayan-Apo or Mr. Lopez received the car from, they thought that that person was the owner of the car. So the defense, the mistake of fact defense, would negate that attendant circumstance element at that point. That's our position.
Is that incompatible with the analysis in Polisbo?
No, I don't think so, because I think Polisbo, because there's language in Polisbo, I go back to, that indicates, number one, it does state nothing in the history of 708-836 indicates that other defenses which may be available to defendant under the penal code were foreclosed by the legislator. Thus, a defendant is free to seek instructions based on defendants generally available under the penal code. talking UCPV, the defenses are quite limited, and I think mistake of fact is one of those defenses. In addition, the...
I'm looking at 3 Pacific 3rd at 521. Here, the only factual mistake which would have absolved defendant from liability under the statute would be a mistaken belief that the owner himself had authorized defendant's use of the vehicle. Defendant did not adduce evidence suggesting that he had obtained the consent of Kali'i Pa'akawa, the van's owner, to operate it. If defendant had presented evidence tending to show that he was under the mistaken belief that the real owner, I insert the word real, had authorized him to operate the vehicle, then the jury would have been instructed on the mistake of fact defense.
I think if Mr. Polizbo had presented evidence that he thought, or he believed, I'm trying to use the word, he mistakenly believed that the co-defendant was the owner of the car, if he had presented evidence of that nature, he would have been entitled to the mistake of fact defense, because he was mistaken as who the owner was at that point.
Well, in your matter, there is no evidence in the record that Doug was, in fact, the registered owner of the vehicle, was there?
We have, well, obviously Doug never testified, but Mr. Minaoppo testified. He testified that he thought he was the owner of the vehicle. And it's clear that in itself, we presented some evidence.
But that's not what Polizbo would permit the mistake of fact defense only if the defendant was mistaken, only if the defendant had correctly identified the registered owner and was under the mistaken belief that that person, who was actually the registered owner, had authorized him to operate the vehicle.
Right. That's the interpretation that the ICA here has. It's basically, it's the conversation or some action.
So Polizbo would not permit the mistake of fact defense on this record, would it?
See, this is where I have to respectfully disagree with you, because I think Polizbo was more narrowly decided. It just decided those facts on that case where the third party, where the defendant received the car from someone who he knew was not the owner of the car. And I think that's what Polizbo was focusing on. And I could be wrong. And the ICA thinks I'm wrong. But that's how I read Polizbo. And therefore, Polizbo didn't foreclose the mistake of fact defense onto each of these elements. Now, I know I'm running into Ms. Nakasone's time, and I can feel her anxiousness, but if this court does think Polizbo did limit the mistake of fact defense to that narrow situation, then I urge you to look at Judge Nakamura's opinion, because when we apply it that way, it makes it a strict liability offense at that point, and we can't have that in a criminal case. You know, it's basically, I lend you my car. I could just set you up at this point. You take my car, and it's stolen. You know, I say it's I'm the owner when Ms. Nakasone is the owner. You don't have a defense. That's not right. So, if this court's reading of Polizbo is that narrow, then I urge this court to look at Judge Nakamura's dissent, because I think that's more fair, more just reading of the statute. This time, I guess I will let Ms. Nakasone address this court. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Deputy Public Defender Karen Nakasone for Mark Lopez. Now, Just following up on the question regarding what Polizzi did say and did not say, our position is that the ICA majority, Judge Nakamura, and the state, they are all misconstruing and misapplying State versus Polizzi as allowing only one specific kind of factual mistake to the exclusion of all other types of factual mistake. And we believe that Polizzi should not sweep so broadly. And where that, all those positions come from, what we would submit is that they are all focusing on a single sentence, and it is the exact sentence that Justice Levinson read, and that sentence is here. The only factual mistake which would have absolved defendant from liability under the statute would be a mistaken belief that the owner himself had authorized defendant's use of the vehicle. But if you continue to read on, the next four sentences that follow clearly say and clarify the scope of the court's holding. And the problem with Polizzi, and the reason why the court went into the legislative history, is that what Polizzi tried to do was to exploit the exact loophole that the 1996 legislature tried to close. Polizzi was claiming that he should get mistake of fact, he should get that defense because he got permission from someone in possession of the car, even though he knew that that person, Kanohokula, was not the owner. And the problem why the legislature changed the law, because like Mr. Tabi said, the definition of owner was so broad that it encompassed anybody in possession of the car, and it could include the car thief. And the defendant could know that the person was a car thief, yet he could still say, well, I believe that was the owner, that person was the owner, and he could try to get the mistake of fact defense. And that's...
Do you believe that Section 836 is plain and unambiguous?
Yes. And there's nothing in the plain language of the statute that shuts down a mistake of fact instruction. Polizzi's holding considered the legislative history just to highlight what was wrong with Polizzi's defense. Polizzi was not even trying to say that he believed Kanohokula, the person he got the car from, was the registered owner. He said something very different. Polizzi was saying, I knew Kanohokula was not the owner and or the registered owner, but I should get the mistake of fact anyway. And that's not the situation we have in my case or Mr. Tabi's case. Now, so our position is that the statute, the legislative history, do not shut down mistake of fact defense. To read Polizzi so narrowly as permitting just one single type of factual mistake to the exclusion of all other type of factual mistakes, we believe is error and is a misreading of Polizzi. Now, this court has held many times in State versus Mayalega, State versus Loquial, that a defendant is entitled to an instruction on a defense or any theory of defense having any support in the evidence, no matter how weak, inconclusive, or unsatisfactory that evidence might be. And Justice Levinson raised some questions about, you know, the key, and of course, you know, we concede in my case that the car was just really busted up. I mean, there's no mincing the facts there. We can't really spin it favorably. The car was very damaged. It was in bad shape. But that makes the evidence weak and unsatisfactory. But still, the test on whether to give a defense instruction is whether, it's not the quality of the evidence, it is whether there is any evidence to support giving the instruction. Furthermore, the test is not the likelihood that the defense will prevail. The condition of the car was not good. In Mr. Minaapo's case, the circumstances in which he identified the car, those don't look so good for the defense. But the standard is, in giving a defense instruction, it is not the likelihood the defense will prevail. It is any evidence. Is there any evidence in the record to support the giving of the instruction? And clearly, in both cases, there was. And we would ask this court to find that mistake of fact should have been given, because we clearly met that very low threshold standard of having any support in the record to support the giving of the defense instruction. State versus Polizzi does not preclude the giving of mistake of fact in these types of UCPB cases. Now, I'd like to, I have about 12 minutes. I'm going to just turn to the issues of prosecutor misconduct, because our position is the misconduct here was egregious and unconstitutional. The two misconduct that we argued to this court is, one, the defendant's failure to say anything about his witness, Greg Romba, to the arresting officer. Now, the prosecutors are going to come up here, and as they said in their opening brief, they're going to say that the officer's testimony, that the defendant did not tell Officer Hawkins anything about Greg Romba. He didn't give you his address. He didn't give you his name. That stuff isn't evidence, so it's fair game to argue it in closing argument. We have no quarrel with that. You can state it in closing. They can state it in closing argument. They can discuss it. They can draw reasonable inferences from that evidence. But just because it's in evidence does not mean they can spin it any way they want. It does not mean that they are permitted to draw unreasonable inferences from the defendant's silence. And here, the inferences that the state drew for the jury were not only unreasonable, they were unconstitutional. The prosecution said in closing argument a total of 3 times over objection that an innocent person in defendant's situation would say something to prevent the wrongful arrest from occurring. That is inviting the jury to draw inferences that are unreasonable and unconstitutional. He's telling the jury that being silent was not consistent with innocence, that being silent is in fact consistent with guilt. And equating silence with guilt strikes at the heart of what the self-incrimination privilege is all about. And the privilege is that no person shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself. Silence under our Constitution is not guilt. Silence is constitutionally protected. Yes.
You are aware that there are some federal decisions which allow the admissibility of such evidence post-arrest but pre-Mirandizing, are you not?
I read whatever was in the cited in the opening brief by our office.
Let me ask you this.
Okay, but I can't pull it out of my head right now, sorry.
Time out. Let me ask you this. In your view, at what point does the right to remain silent kick in?
He was arrested at that point. And upon arrest, the prosecutor argued that as Officer Hawkins was arresting him, he didn't say anything about Greg Romba. He didn't tell you the guy's name. He didn't tell you the guy's address.
Your position is that the deputy prosecuting attorney's argument was unconstitutional because it infringed upon the defendant's right against self-incrimination. When did the right against self-incrimination ripen?
Our position is, we didn't specifically brief that, but once someone is taken into custody, they identify the car as stolen. He is a suspect. They are arresting him for UCPV. He has a right to not say anything at that point, and you can't twist that silence to...
So you're saying at least post-arrest.
At least post-arrest, and that's the situation we have here. So the problem is the jury is left with these inferences, these unfair inferences infringing on his right to remain silent. They are never told that the defendant has a constitutional right to remain silent. They're never told they cannot use his silence to find him guilty. They are not told that they can't use the silence against him in any way, shape, or form. In fact, they are told and left the impression of the exact opposite by the prosecution's argument, that they can use his silence against him, that they can infer guilt from his silence. So yes, the state does have wide latitude to discuss and draw reasonable inferences, but there are limits. They cannot mislead. In State versus Rogan, this court said the prosecution cannot mislead the jury as to the inferences it can draw. The inferences the state invited and exhorted the jury to draw from defendant's silence here were improper, they were misleading, they were unreasonable, they were unconstitutional, and they were misconduct. There was no curative instruction, and there's constitutional violations of a right to a fair trial and right against privilege, against self-incrimination. Now, the second misconduct I wanted to touch upon in the 6 minutes I have remaining is, we believe, also very egregious. This is the where's the witness argument. They didn't bring in Greg Ramba. Now, this argument, they cite State versus Napulo, that they are permitted to comment on that, and they can. They can comment, they can highlight, they can note the lack of corroboration, but here they cross the line because they imply the defendant had a burden to bring the witness, they misled the jury, and they invited the jury to draw conclusions. So, just going through it line by line, in the beginning, and this is reading from transcript at page 134 to 35, and this is quoted in the application. In the beginning, it starts out very innocuous. It starts out very properly. He properly prefaces the argument with, the defendant has no burden. He didn't have to testify. He didn't have to call witnesses. The mere recitation of these magic words does not inoculate everything else from being misconduct proof. Doesn't absolve the prosecution of all the unfair twisting that they did afterward. He continues, wouldn't you have liked to have heard from Greg? He's starting to shift the burden. And it continues, would it have been so hard to get Greg Ramba here to court to tell you he gave defendant the car? And he adds, Ramba is a local boy. He lives in Makakilo. He has already shifted the burden in this argument. It implies that the defendant somehow had a burden, a duty to bring Ramba in, that we had some sort of responsibility to bring Ramba in. It's so easy to bring Ramba in. He lives here on this island. There's no reason for the defense not to bring Ramba in. He lives on this island. So they have already shifted the burden by this insinuation. It continues. Greg is law-abiding. Greg is his friend. Don't you think his friend would come in? More burden shifting. It's telling the jury the defense had every reason to bring Greg Ramba in. So, and they have no reason not to bring him in. That we should be somehow faulted and maybe we're hiding something from the jury by not bringing Greg Ramba in. And then it gets worse because the prosecution argues, if Greg came in, all he would have to say is, I lent him the car. We would say this is blatantly misleading because it suggests to the jury that it's effortless for the defense to be able to bring in a witness like Greg Ramba who's going to make an incriminating statement and to be able to put him on the stand and he's going to be able to simply allow to testify and say, I lent him the car. When the reality is, no judge is going to let Greg Ramba testify without first giving him his right against self-incrimination, advising him of that privilege. And once that's done, no judge is going to let Greg Ramba take the stand and invoke his privilege in front of the jury.
Why is it then that the deputy prosecuting attorney then says, you know, assuming that all of that had happened, I would probably vote not guilty maybe at that point?
That's where
you
I was.
Think there's some irony there?
Yeah, there's no way we would. They would be jumping up and down trying to prevent us from having Greg Ramba say that simple statement, I lent him the car. And because of the evidentiary rules, you know, no judge will allow us to put Greg Ramba up to simply say, I lent him the car. And for the
that statement, I would probably vote not guilty, isn't the prosecution then inferring to the jury that that's what you need to prove not to come back with a verdict of not guilty?
Yes, exactly.
I mean, what other inference would you draw from a statement like that?
Yes, and this court has said you cannot tell the jury what to conclude. I would vote not guilty at that point if they brought this in.
Guilt or not guilty or not guilty goes obviously to burden of proof.
Yes.
So that statement would indicate to the jury that that kind of evidence was what the petitioner needed to bring or should have brought to the jury in order to obtain a verdict of not guilty.
Yes, and that short of that, we're hiding something or we're lying or we don't have faith in our defense or we were lazy or, I mean, that's
trial court had already refused your mistake of fact instruction. Isn't that right?
Yes. And objections were made to this very improper, where's the witness burden shifting arguments. The objections were overruled. No curative instructions were given, and it violated our client's right to a fair trial. And I'm going to just conclude at this point by asking the court to grant a new trial for Mr. Lopez because there were errors of constitutional dimension which occurred. by the denial of the mistake of fact instruction, the improper comment on defendant's right to remain silent, and the burden-shifting arguments that the prosecution was permitted to make to the jury. That these errors individually deprived our client of a fair trial, and even if they did not individually rise to that level, the cumulative effect of not having your one and only defense, the jury wasn't given the mistake of fact instruction, the cumulative effect of all of these errors deprived Mr. Lopez of the right to a fair trial under State versus Amorin. And I will reserve the remainder of our time for rebuttal.
Please, the court. Good morning, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Don Fudo, representing the State of Hawaii, as well as Brian Vincent, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney representing the State of Hawaii. Brian will be representing issues with respect to individual Lopez, and I will be representing issues that are just unique and individual to the other defendants.
It's very long.
As well as the one common issue that I'm thinking is predicate for this court consolidating the arguments. That having been said, as of 1996, with respect to UCPVs, possession is no longer 9/10 of the law. What's happening before this amendment is individuals that just have possession of a vehicle arguably some other aspect of the vehicle given to a defendant. And as the legislature was keenly aware, as was the court in Polisbo, the experienced car thieves, they're aware of this loophole. And they exploit it to their advantage, telling the police that a person known only to them by a first name and whose whereabouts are presently unknown, gave them permission to use that vehicle. That was the state of the law prior to the amendment, because that was the definition of the law. That was by the law. In section 708-800, to the extent people contend that there was no definition of owner prior to the amendment, that's just incorrect. It's just a misspoke. This definition applied when you look at 708-800, the first sentence, in this chapter of which UCP is included, unless a different meaning plainly is required, the following definition applies. With respect to owner, owner means a person, other than the defendant, who has possession of or any interest in the property involved, even though that possession or interest is unlawful. Thus we had, possession was 9/10 of the law, thus we had the law. Creatively, and I'll say effectively, and I'll also be so presumptuous as to say as conceded by the defense when they say that the amendment, when literally read and interpreted, doesn't work in injustice or rendering it serves as a result. What the amendment now says to close this loophole, notwithstanding whatever possession you may or not have, what you need is permission from, just a moment please, the registered owner, or the unrecorded owner of the vehicle pending transfer of ownership. With respect to Ma'anapo, my defendant, and respectfully, I'd like to continue.
Just follow up on a comment that you just made. Is it your position that the 1996 amendment rendered the authorization element, the attendant circumstance that I asked about earlier, a strict liability element?
That's right.
All right. So you concede that for purposes of proving the offense described in 708-836-1, beyond a reasonable doubt, the prosecution bore the burden of proving the requisite state of mind with respect to the operation of the vehicle without the owner's consent?
As defined in paragraph 4, yes. As defined in paragraph 4. Where this argument, as well as the briefs, as well as Nakamura, just as Judge Nakamura's dissent gets off track, is the imprecise and inaccurate non-legal use of the word owner. It's being used in the common vernacular of the person had possession.
Was there any evidence in the record that the defendant knew that Doug was not the registered owner?
Sure there was. What there was him only saying, at best, Doug said it was my car. And here's the other problem with just a mistake of fact in this case, if I may.
Well, if he had identified the it as the car that the defendant operated, would that have been satisfactory?
No, because the definition, as this court has as recently said as yesterday in State versus Gomes, it's the literal application when it's plain and unambiguous. Owner doesn't mean registered owner. Owner would have sufficed pre-amendment or in any other statute where owner is used and it's not specifically defined. But in UCCPV, as a result of the amendment, it's got to be specifically what it prescribes in the statute.
But why does paragraph or subparagraph 4 alter the nature of a mistake of fact defense?
It doesn't
as defined in section 218.
It doesn't alter the nature of the mistake of fact. The question here is not generically whether it precludes it. It's in this specific case, was there any evidence that defendant thought Doug without the last name, whose whereabouts he did not know, who never authorized the specific control of the Nissan Maxima, was the registered owner? What he did was get a key from Doug like this, with no identifying marks as being a Toyota, on a bus. That's my car, go drive it, it's at Shark's Cove. Didn't go that day significantly. The day he went, the defendant repeatedly said, I don't know what car it was. Now, if you don't know what car it was, how can you in the same breath say you had permission to drive that car? Giving you this key, Your Honor, I give you permission to drive any car it fits. So which car is that? Which car have I given you permission to drive? None. So in this case, there wasn't any error in not giving the mistake of fact. The political court never said mistake of fact is categorically not applicable. But what it should be interpreted, like you guys wrote yesterday, when the statute is clear and unambiguous, and as defendant concedes, it wouldn't work an unjust result to apply it literally, they would have had to adduce evidence that defendant, Ma Na Po, thought Doug was the registered owner or the owner pending transfer. You asked counsel that there was none. He didn't identify one line in the transcript where it said that. Co-counsel came up here and gave a conclusory assertion. Yeah, there was clearly evidence. What evidence?
By the plain and unambiguous terms of the substantive offense as described in subparagraph 1, it is the prosecution's burden to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant intentionally or knowingly exerted unauthorized control without the owner's consent. We have testimony in the record that the defendant believed that one of those cars was Doug's, and by process of elimination, he went about undertaking to identify which car that must be by waiting until there was a last car standing. Now, why does that not raise a Section 218 defense?
Because the fact that there was a Nissan Maxima remaining in the parking lot doesn't logically, by any stretch of the imagination, mean that Doug was the registered owner. What they have done is exactly what the legislature told them. They don't have nothing. Just allow the person to come to Doug. He's the person who's on the record. He's your knowledge of the
So, it's your position then that the defendant or a defendant is not entitled to a mistake of fact instruction in defense of a UCPV prosecution unless the defendant affirmatively testifies that he believed that so-and-so was the registered owner of the vehicle?
No, I'm not going to limit it to only that
situation. Well, what kind of evidence would satisfy you?
A forged registration document would satisfy me. So if this defendant had to reach 3 feet over...
So to satisfy you, the record would have to contain evidence that the individual... that the defendant claims is allowing him to operate the vehicle is, in fact, the registered owner.
Well, pursuant to the amendment, that's what the law requires. It's clear and unambiguous. Yes. So if there was a forged registration document that should be in the vehicle under 286-47, and this defendant, Monafo, had reached 3.5 feet over, opened it, and it said, Doug. Okay, mistake of fact. That would be any evidence to suggest that Doug was the registered owner. There is none. And respectfully, I haven't heard the court identify the evidence in the record that would trouble the court or lead the court to believe, yes, he was the Doug was the registered owner. All the record said, all the defendant said it was my car. And inescapable problem. The crime is vehicle specific.
Let me ask you this. Let me give you a hypothetical. You are a parking attendant at a high-end restaurant, and someone drives up to the restaurant, asks for valet parking. It so happens that driver is a car thief, stole the car, and you do your job. You're then charged by complaint with UCPV. Do you have a mistake of fact defense? So that parking attendant is just dead in the water.
As the defense counsel concedes, he posited that hypothetical in his application for the writ of certiorari, and he was also candid and honest enough, and I respectfully respect him for doing it, and saying he knows of situations like that. They never resulted in prosecution. Not one.
But they could.
But they don't. And that hypothetical, he recognizes that the discretion of the prosecutor, as we typically exercise it,
but doesn't
is fair enough to address that situation. Furthermore, Your Honor.
But doesn't it expose at least a conceptual anomaly in your position?
No, it doesn't. Because also, in Volume 14 of HRS, there's a statute, and I'll loosely call it de minimis. So that is de minimis.
In the eye of the beholder, isn't it? At least for charging purposes.
No, because in your hypothetical, you said that valet was honestly believing and doing his job. So it's not in the eye of the beholder, meaning it's in the eye of your hypothetical as you set it up. You set up a situation where I myself go to high-end restaurants. The valet parks the car as he received it from the driver. Now, he is just doing his job. So nowhere in your hypothetical did you give reason for the prosecution to charge that valet. And defendant conceded in his writ that we don't charge in this old nose. And any competent defense counsel in the state would obviously, on your hypothetical's facts, bring a motion for de minimis. And because we're assuming the facts in your hypothetical, the judges in this state would grant the de minimis motion. There would be no prosecution in that hypothetical. So the statute, no, doesn't lead to an absurdity. I go back...
Only if you pronounce the hypothetical de minimis.
No. It wasn't my hypothetical, Your Honor. I'm not parsing words with this, but it was yours. So I'm assuming the facts...
The valet intentionally or knowingly is exerting control over another's propelled vehicle. It turns out that that control is unauthorized because the original driver is not the registered owner. Therefore, the control is unauthorized.
That's true. Under the facts of your hypothetical, that's true. That's how you set up your hypothetical. But it
doesn't. Wouldn't the defendant's defense, if the prosecution chose to prosecute such a matter, for whatever reason, deeming it non-de minimis, which is ultimately the court's call, wouldn't the defense be, I thought that it was that guy's car?
Well, actually, no, because he's represented by counsel, so he would know under subsection 4 that would not be a defense.
That is not. What would his defense be then?
I'm thinking what his defense would be, and as I've seen argued, would be jury nullification. That's what it would be. Because he...
He would have to rely on the jury to nullify an unjust law.
Well, no, Your Honor.
Would that be the valet situation? Is that an absurd instruction of the statute?
It is because you have the position to say it. I did not want to characterize that hypothetical coming from a justice as absurd. As counsel posited it, I will
I'm
say that is an absurd hypothetical.
As a legal concept.
As an absurd hypothetical.
Well, not hypothetical, but applying the statute to that kind of situation, would that be an absurd construction of the statute?
It would, and it also presumes so many errors that just wouldn't happen. Motions to dismiss denied. Prosecutorial just totally just abandoning any discretion and just blindly saying...
It's an absurd construction of the statute. Is the statute plain and unambiguous?
I believe it's plain and ambiguous. Counsel has conceded it's plain and ambiguous. Unambiguous.
So the concept of absurdity would not necessarily apply.
I don't believe it applies. I definitely don't believe it applies. And all this court needs to do is consider what they wrote in their applications. It's never occurred. And to think that there would be so many errors going all the way down the line where we could actually also get the 12 jurors to believe on that set of facts, you're a valet at a high-end restaurant doing your job, and we're going to still find you guilty.
Well, your narrow position with respect to this case is that because no car was ever identified, then there wasn't any... owner identified.
In addition to the fact there was no registered owner, no registered owner or anybody else, including Doug, gave Mr. Manapo permission to drive that Nissan Maxima. You cannot think you hit the jackpot or the lottery. This room clears out. Somebody left a key on the floor. I hang around, I pick up the key, wait until the parking lot's clear. Yeah, that's a pretty nice Lexus. That's not your high-end restaurant hypothetical could be the cost of doing business also. You make sure those valets reach the 3.5 feet over to the glove compartment, and under section 28647, registration document is supposed to be in there.
If the statute is plain and unambiguous, why do we reach legislative history at all?
I don't. They do. They brought it up. I don't think it should be. I think, as I argued in my brief, as I've argued here before the court, he just didn't adduce any evidence at all to support one of the registered owner. Excuse me?
The Lisbo court did, and it's part of our published jurisprudence. Should the Lisbo court have done it? If the statute was plain and unambiguous?
Actually, Justice Levinson, what I didn't prepare for today was just to pontificate as to whether or not Polisbo was rightly or wrongly decided, because I think it's a red herring to make Polisbo the test on this case as to whether or not mistake of fact was erroneously given.
All right, so your position is that we need not give a thought to Polisbo in deciding this case?
No, I'm not saying that. You can give personal opinion just between you and I. Polisbo's rightly decided.
We need not rely on Polisbo, in your view, to decide this case as you would have it decided.
From the decision of the ICA, correct. There is no grave error, because there was not any evidence to show that defendant had permission from the registered owner or owner as defined in the section, nor did he have any permission to drive the specific car which he is accused of operating without control. Not one thing. Counsel didn't identify it. No representative of this court has identified it. So then, intuitively to me, that means there is no such evidence, because it would be a lot simpler and cut the time short if someone just said, Mr. Fudo,
what about on page 15?
There is no such statement. And I believe I read it rather carefully when I see the transcript replete with representations from Doug, where he says, I didn't know which car it was. I don't even know what kind of car he had. What's the mistake of fact then? There isn't any. There just simply isn't any mistake of fact as to what the law requires him to show before the justification for mistake of fact in the inclusion of the charge to the jury would have been warranted. I am not here to make a blanket statement with respect to Polisbo or with respect to Act 195 as negating mistake of fact. I don't think legally that's a sound position. Only in the case of Ma Na Po, as well as Defendant Lopez on this one issue, they didn't adduce evidence to suggest that. They're represented by counsel. The act was well known. They could have said something.
Counsel could have supported.
Furthermore, with respect to Polisbo was decided in 2000. Polisbo was a published decision decided in 2000. It was clear what the court in Polisbo had written with respect to the interpretation of Act 195. Significantly, the next year, in 2001, the legislatures were back with the UCPB statute. Didn't have any problem with Polisbo. Why would I say that? Because the lawful presumptions with respect to tenets of statutory construction are that the legislature knows the law as well as the judicial constructions of the law. Now, if they felt that Polisbo, they being the legislature, was fundamentally wrong, when they went back to 2001, a year after Polisbo, which they presumed to be aware of, they could have addressed it. They did not do it in 2001. And unless I'm mistaken, they didn't do it in 2002, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, wrongly decided? I don't think so.
What did they do in 1999?
In 1999?
Well, there was the amendment that added knowingly, right?
Yes. Why did the legislature, what was the legislature's explanation for adding the knowing state of mind?
I'll defer to Your Honor's recollection. It wasn't germane to my argument. My argument was to see whether or not they mentioned anything in 2001 in adding knowingly that would impact the Polisbo court's interpretation or published opinion, not in one word.
The amendment in 1999 didn't apply to Polisbo himself, so it wasn't discussing Polisbo,
right? Correct. But my point being, the tenet is that they would have been aware of Polisbo had they disagreed with the interpretation.
I understand that, yeah. But to explain your position on the plain and unambiguous statute we're talking about, you resorted to legislative history.
Correct.
Yeah, you pointed out that what the law was prior to the amendment of the statute that was construed in Polisbo.
Correct.
Which is what Polisbo did.
Correct.
Yes. Is it helpful to explain what needs to be proved and what's relevant to look at the legislative history?
According to published case law, it's always relevant to interpretation, whether you, if the court would like to entertain the purpose which motivated the legislature to act.
That was your approach this morning. That was your approach this morning.
Okay. Okay. In the time I have remaining, I would also like to point out as the second issue, specific going to Mr. Ma Na Po, that based on, in large part, what I've already said, the absence of mistake of fact in the charge to the jury was absolutely uncategorically harmless. Based upon what the defendant said and the state of the law, him saying what he did as he testified, and had there been a mistake of fact instruction, it wouldn't have said you can be mistaken just as to the owner. It would have said you'd have to be mistaken as to the fact that Doug was the registered owner. And as much as he never said that, not only the registered owner, and also that he gave you specific permission to drive the Nissan Maxima. You see, Mr. Monopo never said that. So in light of what he did say, as represented by counsel and further under cross-examination, because he didn't say that, the mistake of fact instruction wouldn't have had any effect on all, because it wouldn't have negated the criminal liability. So I will always maintain that under the unique circumstances in Mr. Ma Na Po's situation, no.
Isn't what you're arguing really not so much that the failure to give the instruction, a mistake of fact instruction, was at worst harmless error, but rather the giving of a mistake of fact instruction per Section 218 would have been harmless error, because there is no way on God's earth that any jury would have bought it?
Not there.
Well, so it sounded to me as though you were arguing the weight and effect of the evidence.
No. To argue harmless error, I believe that the state would have to mention the evidence that relates to the fact of why it was harmless. And more so in this case, because what counsel is not challenging in this case is also this instruction which the jury had. Under the law relating to the offense of unauthorized control of a propelled vehicle, a non-owner driver of a vehicle has a legal duty to obtain consent to operate the vehicle directly from the registered owner of the vehicle. They're not saying that's an incorrect statement of the law.
But
that is a correct statement.
That was the instruction that was given in lieu of the defense instruction that was refused. Isn't that right?
This was offered by the prosecution, so I will say no.
This was the prosecution's alternative to the defense instruction, wasn't it?
No, I'm not understanding the record like that. The prosecutor wanted this instruction as well as an instruction on the law. It wasn't in lieu of, it wasn't a barter. This was also an instruction he wanted, that he got that at this argument and at no time for this argument, that they said is an incorrect statement of the law. So if the jury is instructed, the defendant, Mr. Ma Na Po, must get the permission to operate the definitive adverb, means the Nissan Maxima, directly from the registered owner. Nancy Cordova and her boyfriend came and testified. We don't know this person. We never gave him permission to drive. So he failed. They would know he failed. So the mistake of fact instruction, the absence thereof, it was harmless beyond any doubt, because there was no evidence that that Mr. Ma Na Po thought Doug was the registered owner.
My problem is that I don't hear you, even though you suggest that you are, to be making a harmless error argument. You're arguing that as a matter of law, there was no factual support in the record for a mistake of fact instruction, and therefore it was properly withheld. Isn't that your argument?
That's the primary argument, but I think as a prudent advocate, I'm compelled to say, assuming arguendo, it was erroneously withheld.
Well, arguendo, what would be the basis for the erroneous withholding?
Nothing.
Well, that's my point.
That's my point. That's why I don't believe it was germane, but I just believe as a complete advocate, because of State versus Nichols, I am not you folks. So I wish I could assume, based upon the tenor of questions or just the tenor of the court, that you were with me. And then I would say, okay, I stop right here. But I can't. I know sometimes the court is very pleasant with us, and then perhaps it gets completely reversed, like Gomes. So, you know, I'm not going to make any assumptions, Your Honor. I'm going to do what State versus Nichols said. Until you tell me, you're correct, Mr. Fudo, as a mistake, as a matter of law, it wasn't warranted in this case, and I thank you. And now I will sit down unless there's further questions.
Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Brian Vincent for the state. With respect to State v. Lopez, I would just adopt my colleague's arguments with respect to the mistake of fact issue.
All right. Having done that, could we take a look for purposes of the mistake of fact piece of this appeal at the portion of the rebuttal argument that counsel focused on with respect to the absence of Greg Romba? You're familiar with that. Do you find any fault with the argument the deputy prosecuting attorney made?
I think that, taken as a whole, I would submit that that was a may have been an awkward articulated, but I believe it was a fair comment on the fact that there was no corroborating.
What do you infer from the statement, I would probably vote not guilty maybe at that point, based on what?
That's his personal opinion.
Well, I mean, isn't the compelling inference that that statement was based on the hypothetical testimony, yeah, I lent him the car, I told him it was okay, and I never told it was stolen either. Greg is law-abiding, honest, his friend. You know, don't you think his friend would come in? And all he would have to say is, yeah, I lent him the car. And then the DPA says, I would probably vote not guilty maybe at that point. Doesn't that impliedly concede the viability, potentially, of a Section 218 defense, assuming the testimony that he recited?
Well, I don't know how that connects to the fact defense issue.
I would probably vote not guilty, presumably because I would have reasonable doubt as to guilt, and the only basis for that based on that argument would be given the testimony regarding Greg's statements that would give rise to a mistake of fact as to whose car the thing was.
I believe maybe he perhaps misunderstood what the law was as far as the mistake of fact.
Oh, and that's why he objected to the defense's proposed Section 218 mistake of fact instruction.
I
understand the problem.
I agree that both of the comments that the defendant raises raise problems. Okay, and I don't deny that they were at the very least inarticulately worded. And I
you could even construe them as a concession, couldn't you?
I would just say a few words, and I would argue that whatever whatever error in the prosecutorial comments, they were harmless. I think if you look at it under the scenario where if the court was correct, as we contend, that no mistake of fact instruction should have been given, then I think that this error is harmless, because the thrust of these two comments are the credibility of the witness. And I think in this case, if you don't have any evidence that the defendant inquired as to whether the person who gave the permission to use the car was a registered owner or otherwise the legal owner as defined in the use of UCTV statute, I think that credibility is not even relevant in this case anymore. I think that it hardly, I would submit that it hardly even matters whether, I mean, I don't think there's anything that the defendant could say if he, other than that I thought this person was a registered owner, or I checked the registration papers, that would be relevant in this case, I believe. If this court does find that a mistake of fact should have been given, I still believe that the error was harmless in this case, because and
is the attendant circumstance element of the offense, namely controller operation without the registered owner's consent, a strict liability element?
I have not argued. We have not argued that in our briefs. I believe that it may have been stated at trial, but that's not our position. That it's a strict liability case.
Was it just stated at trial?
I believe so. I
took the position it's a strict liability statute.
I believe the words strict liability would be. And I don't agree that it's strict liability. I don't believe the trial court made its decision based on that. And the court's ruling on whether or not a mistake of fact instruction should have been given, there's no mention of strict liability in that.
I'm sorry, this is in the Lopez case.
Right.
Where the term strict liability was used.
And I guess the reason why I would argue there's overwhelming evidence in this case is that as the defendant conceded, the car in our case was really busted up. Okay, that in itself is not enough to say no one. Okay,
Mr. Vincent, in the case of it does seem like an overwhelming evidence. I mean. The story is not believable, shall we say. Although we don't judge credibility up here, it's a far-fetched story. But, so why does the prosecution have to comment on the defendant not bringing witnesses? Or not saying to the police officer? I mean, doesn't that send constitutional shivers up your spine?
I would acknowledge that at least the comment on the fact that the defendant didn't tell the officer that I've got a break bomb. I would admit that's a problem. I believe it's arguable the other situation, whether you call Rama to the stand or not. The real problem is that it's something that I think the defendant argues that the prosecutor there is going to argue his own personal opinion.
Well, he's not supposed to argue his own personal opinion, is that correct?
That's right. And I'm not going to. I'm just going to say that the defendant can see the car was really busted up. I think that alone is just evidence of extremely reckless state of mind. But I would draw your attention to the transcripts where Officer Hawkins testifies, and pages 44 to 46, summarize the testimony there. When Officer Lopez came to the window and asked him for the registration, and the defendant wasn't interested, he asked him to turn the ignition off. And I think at that point, this is the important point. Overwhelming evidence is that he takes the key in both hands, he reaches under that towel, okay? He doesn't want the officer to see that that steering column is stripped. And I think that is the piece of evidence that makes it clear that he was aware that this was a stolen car, not just that he was unauthorized to operate this car, but this was actually a stolen car. And I would just argue that this particular jury would not have reached a different conclusion, even if the mistake of action instruction, even if the comments had not been made.
So now you are making a harmless error argument.
That's it. Nothing else.
Ms. Nakasone will literally kill me if I go over her time. Just quick points, real quick. The hypothetical is the parking valet. There is also another hypothetical that I did present in the writ. It's where a person actually buys the car with documents, pays money, victimized. I represented someone who did that. That person, multiple times, the victims didn't get charged in those cases. I concede that to Mr. Fudo. However, we represent many people with that same defense, the same problem. They say, I bought the moped for $600. I bought this junk car for this much money. I told me the papers will get. This is common. We go to trial on these cases many times. We win many times. Sometimes the risk is too great that we end up plea bargaining these cases. But these people do get charged in those situations. So it's not that that the prosecutor is all-knowing and says, we're not going to charge people in those difficult situations. They do get charged, and we have to defend them. Number two, the forged reg document. I guess that's a hypothetical. If Mr. Fudo borrows a car from me, I show him a forged reg document. If it's a forged document, that doesn't make me the registered owner. What makes a person the registered owner is what's registered with the state of Hawaii. I'm still not the registered owner. He believes I'm the registered owner, so just because I show him the document, he should be entitled to the mistake of fact defense. But according to his hypo, just because I show him the document, I'm the registered owner, he needs to rely on the mistake of fact defense to be acquitted of the charge. People who not only take the extra step and hide the fact, especially if I try to sell him the car at that point, I would obviously show him a forged reg document. So the mistake of fact defense is needed. And Justice Levinson, I guess there's an emphasis on whether this law is plain and unambiguous. It really is plain and unambiguous. And because it is, the mistake of fact defense is needed. Because a person can honestly believe he bought the car from a person who he thought was the owner. Now, Mr. Fudo talks about, okay, in our case, we only said, Mr. Miles said, I believe he was the owner. He told me he was the owner. Maybe the term of art, but owner is, that's all that's needed for UCPB. They go into, the statute defines who an owner is, but I think we can imply that when Mr. Mayanapo testified, I thought Doug was the owner, means he was the legal registered owner of the vehicle. I think that inference can be made to the jury at that point. And talking about both facts in this case, Justice Nakayama mentions that the facts in Lopez, it's kind of far out there. And even our case where last car standing was was Doug's car, so to speak. Well, in State v. Kavnis, the ICA clearly stated an unreasonable mistake of fact may or may not be reckless. So basically, right now, a mistake of fact defense as it stands now, even if it's a reckless state of mind, it's a mistake of fact, that if the jury believes that reckless state of mind. Obviously, it's going to be I would think that it would be more difficult when it's reckless, but nonetheless, the instruction must be given and the jury must be able to consider whether to believe the reckless state of mind. A reckless mistake of fact, because a reckless mistake of fact will negate the intent and knowing of whether the person who got the car was the actual owner. So, basically, again, because the law itself is plain and it's not absurd and unjust, if we don't have the mistake of fact, though, as applied, it will be. That's why the legislator, that's why the courts, we have a mistake of fact defense. And it's in those situations that people, defendants, who unwillingly borrow a car from somebody, buy a car from somebody, could have a defense saying, whoa, I didn't know, I really didn't know. And let the jury decide based on the condition of the car, based on the circumstances I got, how I received the car. But the jury should be able to decide that issue, and the jury should have been instructed on that. I'm about halfway through, and Ms. Nakasone is anxious here again. So thank you very much.
The plain and unambiguous language of the statute, I mean, that's been a constant refrain in this argument. The statute clearly requires a knowing state of mind. The attendant circumstance element that we're dealing with here is the fact that the person must know that their use of the car is unauthorized. And there is nothing in the plain language of the statute. It contains a state of mind. It contains an attendant circumstance under 702-204, 702-205, 702-207, State versus Iwohi, State versus Jenkins, State versus Valentine. This court has reaffirmed those statutes. A state of mind applies to all elements, including the attendant circumstance element. And here, the one we're dealing with is the fact that the defendant must know the use was unauthorized. The plain and unambiguous language of the statute contains a state of mind, and there's an attendant circumstance element, and the mistake that's at issue, the mistaken belief that we are raising, tends to negative that particular element of proof, that you must know that your control is unauthorized. So if we present evidence, and we're saying that we did, if you present evidence tending to show and negating that state of mind required for that particular attendant circumstance, you get the benefit of the defense. Now, Mr. Fudo and I believe Mr. Vincent said that the only way we should be able to get mistake is if someone actually checked the registered owner's papers, or if the defendant has to clearly state, I thought that so-and-so was the registered owner, that would be the only limited circumstance where we would get mistake of fact. But the clear and unambiguous language of the statute does not require you to particularly state registered owner in order to qualify for mistake of fact defense.
Yeah. What about Mr. Fudo's argument that that is a prerequisite to entitlement to a Section 218 defense with respect to UCPV by virtue of the definition of owner as contained in subparagraph 4?
Well, they may have particularly defined registered owner, but you know that they narrowed the scope of the definition of owner, but it still doesn't take away from the fact that it's their burden of proof to show that they met beyond a reasonable doubt that he knowingly knew that his control was unauthorized, that he knowingly didn't have the permission of the owner. And yes, the definition may say it can only be the registered owner, but if there's any evidence showing that defendant was mistaken as to who the owner was, we would argue the statute still allows that, and it doesn't shut down the mistake of fact defense. And if we go beyond the clear and unambiguous language of the statute, you go through the legislative history, There's nothing there that shuts down the mistake of fact defense. Even in 1999, I think one of the justices raised the 1999 amendments. All they did in 1999 was they included a lower standard of mind. They made it easier for the prosecutors to prosecute these cases by adding knowingly. They didn't go so far as to include reckless. They said, well, we're not going to go that far. We're just going to stick in knowing, and that makes it easy for the prosecutors to prosecute, and it makes it harder for the defense to defend. It does not take away the mistake of fact defense, and we would ask the court to follow Judge Nakamura's analysis on the legislative history, that it does not shut down the mistake of fact defense. Now, one final point I wanted to bring up is, did the prosecutor at trial say it was strict liability? And I think it was unclear whether he did say it or he didn't say it, but he did. And we referenced this in the reply brief at page 6, top of page 6. The counsel who authored the brief quotes from February 1st, 2006 transcript at page 87. And I pulled up the actual transcript, and the prosecutor makes a long argument about what Polispo means and doesn't mean. But on page 87, in the first paragraph in the middle, the paragraph in the middle of the page, he says, however, the state's position is that even though Polispo does seem, in the state's reading of it, to impose what amounts almost to a strict liability on that element, and then he goes on to say, the state would point out that this is a Class C felony, and then he's talking about how they have strict liability in sex assault cases where the person is underage. So he's conceding that it does look like strict liability. So they did concede that at trial, and that argument was made on the record. And without a mistake of fact defense, or shutting down the mistake of fact defense in our kinds of cases, you are, in effect, creating a strict liability statute. And that's not a clear and unambiguous reading of the statute, and the legislative history does not indicate an intent to create a strict liability offense. And to conclude, we would ask this court to grant a new trial for Mr. Lopez and Mr. Maynaapo based on the myriad of errors of constitutional magnitude that were committed. These errors were not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Mistake of fact was the main defense that both defendants relied upon. So for them to say that it was harmless, it was not. Harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Is there a reasonable possibility that the lack of the instruction contributed to the conviction? And we feel the only answer you can reach there is yes, it did contribute. And in closing, Mr. Tabe and I would like to thank this court for this opportunity to present full argument on this issue that has vexed the trial courts for years, and we eagerly await your decision on this. Thank you.
Thank you, all counsel. We'll take this matter under advisement.